de voi să vă amintesc.
各位观众大家好，我是卡拉，欢迎收看美国观察。拜登总统周三宣布了对乌克兰价值7亿美元的第11轮军事援助，稍后的节目中我们一同关注。6月2号是俄罗斯入侵乌克兰第100天，拜登总统在周三宣布对乌克兰价值7亿美元的第11轮军事援助。白宫资深官员表示，美国提供的武器属于防卫性武器。详细情况请美国之音白宫记者黄耀毅来介绍。耀毅，
拜登昨天5月31号呢投书《纽约时报》，在当中除了是重申对乌克兰的承诺之外，也指出乌克兰与俄罗斯的和谈之所以停滞，原因是因为俄罗斯继续出兵来占领乌克兰的土地。那拜登总统也说呢，无论是在公开或者是私底下呢，他都不会要求乌克兰要割地求和，因为那是错误的，而且也抵触现有的原则。那白宫则在6月1号来星期三的时候进行宣布说，基于之前美国国会跨党派通过的援助乌克兰的这个法案呢，这现在对乌克兰进行新一轮的军事援助。那么在星期二晚上白宫国安会的背景简报会上，一位资深官员说，这是拜登政府对乌克兰第11轮的军事援助，总值约7亿美元。而资深官员说呢，乌克兰方面从4月到5月都一直在告诉美国说，他们所需要的是火炮，所以呢在这一轮的援助当中就有考虑这个他们的军事的需求。那拜登政府这一次宣布第11轮新的军事援助的项目则包括下面几项，有这高机动火炮火箭系统、反击雷达跟防空雷达、标枪反坦克导弹、四针防空导弹、反装甲武器、无人机 MI-17 直升机弹药，还有各式的武器保修的装备。那么在这个白宫的国安会的资深官员则是表示呢，他说强调说，现在是乌克兰是俄罗斯在入侵一个主权国家，并不是乌克兰在入侵俄罗斯。不过呢，他也强调说，美国现在提供给这个乌克兰的，并非是属于防卫性的武器，而不是能够攻击到俄罗斯境内的。他说呢，俄罗斯也向美国保证不会利用这些武器来攻击俄罗斯的领土，只会用来自我防卫。而美国是相信乌克兰做出的承诺。而白宫发言人尚皮耶在星期三的白宫新闻简报上再次的重申了美国对乌克兰的承诺。我们看一下尚皮耶怎么说。
The people of Ukraine continue to inspire the world with their courage and resolve as they fight bravely to defend their country and their democracy against Russian aggression. The United States will stand with our Ukrainian partners and continue to provide Ukraine with weapons and equipment to defend itself. The new package will arm them with new capabilities and advanced weaponry, including HIMARS, with battlefield munition to defend their territory and Russian advances. We continue to lead the world in providing historic assistance to support Ukraine's fight for freedom, and that is going to continue to be our focus.
白宫国安会的资深官员说呢，美国的目标是很直接的，就是要来确保一个民主、独立、拥有主权、繁荣，并且拥有吓阻跟保卫自己免受侵略的手段的乌克兰。而拜登总统的最终目的呢，是一个和平稳定的欧洲以及一个和平稳定的国际秩序。卡拉，
好的，感谢姚毅的连线报道。美国海军宣布将举行第28届环太平洋军事演习，展示参演国海上力量的广泛能力和内在灵活性。演习将从6月29日开始，在夏威夷和南加利福尼亚州海域举行，一直延续到8月4日。军演的主题是能力适应性伙伴。澳大利亚、加拿大、智利、印度、印度尼西亚、丹麦、法国、英国、德国、日本、韩国和菲律宾以及新加坡等26个国家将派出38艘水面舰艇、4艘潜艇、9国的陆战部队、170多架飞机和大约25000名官兵参加本次演习。美国第三舰队说，军演的目的是培养并维护合作关系，这种关系对确保海上通道和世界互联海洋的安全至关重要。美国和台湾推出对深化双边关系，特别是经贸关系至关重要的美台21世纪贸易倡议。 美国主管亚太地区贸易事务的副贸易代表沙拉比亚奇星期三与台湾官员举行视频会晤。美国贸易代表办公室说，此项倡议旨在为双方基于共享的价值深化经贸关系，推动相互的贸易优先要务。美台21世纪贸易倡议首轮谈判将于本月稍后在华盛顿举行。台湾总统蔡英文周三对倡议作出高度评价。另一方面，欧盟与台湾预定于星期四举行贸易与投资对话。欧盟在对话前夕决定将对话的官员层级由技术官员提升到司局长及部长级，受到了台湾官方的欢迎与肯定。欧盟是台湾最大的直接外资来源地。美国商务部长雷蒙多说，拜登政府正在对中国公司逃避美国制裁的行为展开调查，并积极考虑将更多的中国公司列入黑名单。雷蒙多部长说，受制裁的中国公司会采取包括设立新公司等花招逃避美国的制裁，美国对此已经警觉，并且加大努力予以制止，包括与美国的盟友协调出口控制措施。美国商务部目前已经将中国上百家公司列入商务部的实体清单，这些实体涉嫌参与侵犯人权、南中国海军事化和侵犯美国知识产权等行为。一份最新的全球民调显示，有一半受访国家的民众赞成如果中国入侵台湾就与中国断绝经济关系。这份名为民主认知指数的问卷调查由国际非营利组织民主联盟基金会和德国的一家民调机构合作进行，调查于今年的3月30日至5月10日之间进行。接受调查的53个国家之中，有26个国家的多数民众表示，如果中国入侵台湾就应该切断与中国的经济联系。这些国家包括美国、日本、韩国和德国等许多中国的主要贸易伙伴，合计占中国贸易总额的一半以上。拜登政府近来在台湾问题上的表述引发热议。前美国国防部长埃斯珀在接受美国之音专访时说，拜登总统在日本所说的美国会军事保卫台湾并非口误，而是预示着美国政府在台湾问题上的战略模糊政策或将终结。
Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary, for speaking with Voice America today. I would like to start with your take on President Biden's recent remarks on Taiwan.A couple of days ago in Tokyo, he indicated that the U.S. would defend Taiwan militarily if China attempts to take Taiwan by force. White House officials walked back the remark, later saying the president was only promising U.S. aid to help Taiwan defend itself. And then President Biden himself clarified that the U.S. hasn't changed its strategic policy on Taiwan.Do you think it's just, you know, President Biden misspoke a little bit, or it's indicating that the administration is seriously considering ending its strategic ambiguity on Taiwan?
Well, first of all, it's great to be with Voice of America today, so thank you very much. Look, I think President Biden's remark was very important. It, in my view, constitutes a change in policy.It's not the first time he said it. It's, in fact, the third time. And it's also the third time that the White House tried to walk it back and explain it away, which is confounding to me and many others. Look, I've said before that I think that the One China policy in the decades since relationships were changed in the 1970s has run its course, that Taiwan and China have developed and evolved in different ways.That now warrants a new approach, a new policy. And I think that there's less ambiguity today than there was before with regard to whether or not the United States would defend Taiwan. So I think President Biden made a clear statement. Now, of course, he doesn't get into the details of whether that means troops or just logistical support or whatnot, but he wouldn't be able to offer that anyways. It all depends on the situation and what else is happening at the time. But I view it as,A policy change, I think it is warranted, and I give him credit for making such a bold statement.
In your newly published book, Sacred Oath, you argue that the time has come for the U.S. to review its One China policy. Are you suggesting an end to the strategic ambiguity on Taiwan?
Yeah, I think it makes sense to move beyond ambiguity to clarity. And by the way, I wrote the book a year ago. It's just now coming out after DOD reviews and whatnot. And my view is, given the situation in the Taiwan Strait and the fact, frankly, that China's approach toward Taiwan has been very threatening. We've seen over the last several years, we've seen Chinese naval and air movements into Taiwanese airspace, and we've seen heated rhetoric. So look, they are not abiding but by a core foundation of One China policy and at least the Taiwan Relations Act and communiques, which basically said that all parties agreed to that the future of Taiwan should be resolved peacefully. And by the way, in the Taiwan Relations Act, as I recall, the law actually states that were either party to try and address the future of Taiwan in an unpeaceful means, and we would consider that a grave security threat, which implies that there would be a U.S. military role.
Mm. But given the strong reaction from Beijing, is it possible to change the U.S. policy on Taiwan without provoking armed conflict with the PRC?
Well, that's a challenge, and that's a challenge I wrote about in my book. My preference would be that a change in policy not be done through a press conference, but rather it first be done behind closed doors with our greatest partners and allies in the region, that it be coordinated, for example, with Tokyo and Seoul and with Australia and the Philippines and others, and that it come out in a more deliberate manner with providing sufficient strategic context, explaining the reasons behind the change and so on. And so that's kind of what I argued for in my book, a more thoughtful approach, a more deliberate and a more coordinated rollout. But obviously he got asked the question and the president was candid in his remarks and in his views. And as I said, he stated it three times now over the past several months.
Speaking of possible armed conflict with the PRC over Taiwan issue, the U.S. military has been working for years on the operation plans for such contingency. In your book, you talk about a war plan that has been constantly updated. So even though Washington has been intentionally vague about whether it will come to Taiwan's defense if Beijing attacked, the U.S. military is very clear about what to do at each stage of a Taiwan contingency. There is no ambiguity about that, right?
Well, the United States military prepares plans for any type of contingency around the world that may involve U.S. interests and could involve the United States military. So that's part and parcel of our day-in, day-out planning. Obviously, we've known since the relationship has changed, and obviously since the new turn that China has taken under Xi Jinping, that there is a possibility of conflict in the Taiwan Strait, and by the way, in the South China Sea and other parts of the world as well, with various other states. So you have to plan and be deliberate about it because that is the responsible thing to do.
About the plan, of course, it's classified. I assume you cannot review too much about it, but could you at least tell us if the plan, when you were in charge, of course, included sending troops to Taiwan? If so, under what circumstance?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't talk about DOD operational plans.
So let me ask you this way. According to a recent survey, over half of Taiwan residents do not believe the U.S. would send troops in response to a Chinese attack. The share has doubled compared with before Russia's invasion of Ukraine. What messages you would like to send to those people as a former U.S. defense secretary?
Look, I think any country that's under threat from a neighbor or somebody else first and foremost should rely on themselves for their self-defense and not others to come to their aid. I've said publicly that I think Taiwan needs to do more to improve their defenses. I think they need to invest more of their GDP as a percentage into their defenses. I think they need to expand conscription, both in terms of the breadth and length. I think they need to look at different types of arms purchases to take on a more asymmetric defense, such as we've seen in Ukraine. So I think first and foremost, Taiwan needs to rely on Taiwan and not think that the United States or another country is going to come to its aid. Because in my view, a population that is organized and trained and equipped to push back against a bigger power is a far greater deterrent than leaving your fate to somebody else.
Mm. So in fact, there are other ways to defend Taiwan military against China's invasion without actually sending troops to Taiwan, right, for the U.S.?
Well, there are many ways to defend. More importantly, there are many ways to deter. And so much of that depends really on the stance that China takes at the end of the day, is what does China plan to do and how do they plan to do it? And look, I would encourage Beijing, as I have over the years, to work with the government in Taipei and improve relationships and have discussions about these matters of concern to Beijing in a peaceful diplomatic manner and not threaten them with overflights of fighters and bombers and the sailing of warships into their waters.
I'm wondering, how urgent is it to have this kind of discussion? How do you see PRC's readiness to take over Taiwan by force?
Well, only the PRC military really knows, the PLA, People's Liberation Army, knows how ready they are. And, but there's consequences, right? It's a risky proposition. They have to, depending on what their plans are to do such a thing, and there are risks and there are consequences. And I think what Beijing has seen based on Russia's invasion of Ukraine, that the consequences of a unwarranted Chinese assault or action against Taiwan could result in economic isolation, political isolation, and have a dramatic impact on the Chinese economy, to say the least.
As you've just pointed out, since Chinese President Xi Jinping took office, there has been a significant buildup of China's armed forces. In your book, you talk about China's development of land-based ballistic and cruise missiles. Do you find it particularly threatening to the U.S. and to Taiwan?
Well, every country has the right to defend itself. I just make a point of the fact that they have over 1,000 or so missiles on the mainland opposite Taiwan and other areas. And that's something, if you're a planner, you have to take into account. It's just a fact of a critical element, I think, of China's defense that has to be factored into those of us who are concerned about China's ascent.
You also mentioned that PLA's missile system were integral to China's anti-access, or called area denial strategy, for the Western Pacific. What's your assessment of the strategy of China? Why do you call it a major obstacle for the U.S. to overcome if we ended up in a conflict?
Well, it's been the view, and I think that China has stated it, that they want to control the waters within the nine-dash line. They claim it as territorial waters going back historically, but that uncovers waters and areas claimed by several other countries in the Western Pacific, from Vietnam and Indonesia to the Philippines to Japan and elsewhere. So they want to control that first nine-dash line, the first island chain, and clearly get out to the second island chain, which involves many Pacific island countries, and control those waterways. And look, those waterways aren't for China to control, number one. Secondly, Chinese control of those waterways would have a dramatic impact on international trade and would affect many, many countries, not just in the region, but around the world. So, look, I'll go back to the basics. I want to see a China that continues to grow and thrive and prosper, but does so within current international rules and norms and frameworks, and not doesn't try to break them or bend them or violate them. And we've seen too much of that over the past many years. And that's the issue we have.
So how would you compare the maritime capability between China and the U.S. nowadays?
Well, in terms of capital ships, warships, I think the United States Navy is the best in the world, hands down. But China is growing its Navy in terms of size and capacity and capability. And it's something we have to be alert to. That's why I propose to modernize the United States military in both its size and capability in dramatic ways if we're going to continue to deter the PLA Navy from whatever plans they may have in the future.
Let's talk more about the specifics on this issue. You know, given the rising military capability of the PRC, what's the right way for Taiwan to build up its own defense? In your book, you mentioned that you pressed the Taipei to spend more on the right mix of forces and weapons. What do you mean by right mix?
Well, I think it begins with building a capable territorial defense where As many of the 23 million Taiwanese people on the island know how to use a weapon or know how to defend their town, their community, their block, whatever the case may be, and they know how to organize if the PRC tries to seize the island. That would be number one. Number two, on the conventional military force, I think, you know, the Taiwanese military needs to make sure it has the capability to defeat an amphibious assault. That could include anti-ship cruise missiles and mines, but it also means the systems that we see, again, Ukraine using, such as anti-tank weapons, anti-aircraft weapons, handheld weapons that would allow the Taiwanese people to fight in small groups in an insurgent mode, if you will, should the PLA invade.
That goes into the next question I would like to ask. There are reports about the Biden administration quietly pressing Taipei to order American-made missiles and smaller arms for asymmetric warfare rather than weapons designed for, you know, conventional set-piece warfare. Do you think it's necessary?
Well, I'm not familiar with, I don't have any inside knowledge, if you will. I read what you probably read, but to me that makes sense. That there be a balanced approach, that it's not just high-end military equipment that's used by a professional military, but also other equipment that could be used by, again, smaller groups of professional soldiers or a militia or a territorial defense. I think it needs to be a balanced approach because, you know, the PLA military is much, much bigger and capable than the Taiwanese military. So what you have to do is figure out how to create a deterrent force of 23 million Taiwanese that would make the possible seizure of Taiwan by the PLA very, very risky, very uncertain, and very, you know, very bloody, if you will, should they pursue to do that.
I'm wondering how much of the, you know, strategy could be applicable to the U.S., you know, when it comes to build up the U.S. military capability. As you've just mentioned, the Ukraine war has proved the superiority of anti-platform weapons. So some military experts have suggested the U.S. give up its platform-centric view and stop investing heavily in expensive platforms like battle tanks or aircraft. Do you agree?
I agree to some measure. You always need tanks on the modern battlefield. You always need, you know, manned fighters. You always need some degree of manned ships. But, for example, the naval force structure that I put forth in the fall of 2020 called Battle Force 2045 had much greater emphasis on a smaller distributed fleet of warships, many of them manned or optionally manned or unmanned to do that. Because I believe that the future is going to be in long-range precision weapons that don't require a platform to launch them, but rather can be launched from the mainland or somewhere else. So I think that is where history and technology is taking us.
Besides Taiwan, what are the other flashpoints that might lead to armed conflicts between the U.S. and China?
Well, if you just look in the Western Pacific, there are a number of areas. We talked about the Taiwan Strait. I think North Korea is a possibility. If the DPRK attacks the Republic of Korea, could that war broaden? You know, obviously, the United States would get involved, as would Japan, maybe others. Then you have the South China Sea, where China has laid claim to any number of islands. And then you have every now and then these conflicts pop up in other parts of the South China Sea, whether it's between China and the Philippines or China and Indonesia, other places where their maritime militia is active, and they're trying to lay claim to different parts of the Western Pacific. So I think all those are flashpoints. We can keep going around to, for example, the Himalayas with the Indians. We had a clash there in 2020 between the Indian military and the PLA. So if you look mostly around the periphery of China, at least in the south and east, you see a lot of areas where conflict could break out.
Given there are so many flashpoints, I believe it's your belief that it's very important for the two militaries to improve their communication to reduce the chances of miscalculations. As a, you know, a defense secretary, you reached out early on to your Chinese counterpart and tried to maintain a pace of communication. You actually talked to Wei Fenghe multiple times. What's your impression of him?
Yes, you're right. I think it's very important that both countries talk, particularly countries that are competing with one another, as we were with China. And I thought it was important that we have that dialogue so that we could prevent misunderstandings, address misperceptions, resolve issues and conflicts and whatnot. So I reached out early on to Minister Wei to build that relationship. And we tried to talk every few months. And certainly if we were in the same place at the same time, we tried to meet. So, for example, in I think at an ASEAN meeting in Bangkok in 2019, we met. And so I think it's very important. I was he was affable and informed and willing to listen to me, and I listened to him. And we just tried to talk and keep that line of communication open, because I think it's important to build that during a non-contentious period, so that if something happens, that you at least have a level of trust and communication that will allow you to talk during difficult times.
In your book, you said you actually recognized that Wei Fenghe wasn't truly an equal when it came to authority and power in his own system, but he was your best point of entry. We know that China has constantly denied the requests of U.S. defense secretaries to speak to its highest ranking uniformed officer like General Xu Qiliang, right? So are you concerned about this?
Well, I'm concerned that there has not been a dialogue or there was not a dialogue between the Pentagon and the Chinese military at the highest levels for some period of time. As I recall, Secretary Austin recently spoke with Minister Wei. Look, at the end of the day, it's we have differences in our organizations and rank structures. I was willing to talk to Minister Wei because I think it's important to have those lines of communication open. I would prefer to speak to my actual equivalent, but that wasn't the case. But it's better to speak to someone than no one.
Do you think it might reduce the effectiveness of, you know, communication with the Chinese military?
Well, it could, but that's their decision. If something happens and there's a misunderstanding, then that's on them, not me. I try to reach to the right person, and as did Secretary Austin, and clearly the Chinese do not want that level of communication for some reason.
What would be your suggestions for the Biden administration to push forward the China focus, especially during the time when the Ukraine crisis seemed to take much of its attention and the resources?
Well, I think the president needs to continue. It needs to have direct contact with his counterpart, Xi Jinping, to explain all of our concerns with China and its behavior, and look for areas not just to compete, but areas to cooperate where we might build some trust and build some bonds. But at the same time, you also have to increase the relationships between our allies and partners in the region, beginning with our bilateral alliances with, for example, Australia, the Philippines, Seoul, Korea, and Japan, and then work on the partnerships as well, whether it's Vietnam and Indonesia or Mongolia, and build that up and get show American leadership in not just the military context, but also the diplomatic and economic and trade, so that we can stand firm and defend, again, the international rules-based order and norms that have really allowed countries around the world to prosper and thrive and communities to grow now for 75 plus years.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary, for your time.
包括习近平在内的数代中国领导人从未对六四屠杀表达悔过。历史见证者、前解放军报中校记者江林镇压当晚遭武警殴打之后留下了血衣，他的血衣由前学运刘秀、周峰所收藏。
这件展品是89年6月3日晚上，当时江林和抗议的学生民众在一起被戒严部队殴打所留下的血衣，当年这种血腥镇压一个比较直接的证据。江林的身份非常特殊，他当时实际上是军人身份。 是解放军报的记者，他是特别代表了那个时代，就是北京民众、社会各界同仇敌忾，在这种暴力镇压面前表现出的那种勇气和力量。
以上就是今天美国观察的全部内容，感谢您的收看，我们明天再见。